Well, we will return to this after we have spoken to the author, Mahdi Nazim Royal, who I think has joined us. Are you there, Mahdi? Hello?
I can faintly hear you.
Oh, now I bet you can hear me.
Now I can hear you perfectly. Hi, Phil.
I just saw somebody push a button. I said, oh, I'm going to hear him this time. Thank you, Mahdi. You're very patient. We had a little glitch there, but we're very anxious to talk to you. Let's first talk about the fact that, once again, you have gone to the place to do the work. You write wonderful articles and books, but you also go and sometimes put your life on the line, as you did in the case of Libya. Actually, you have been to Syria, which is also, just because of the politics and the role of great powers, somewhat risky. But can you tell us, let's start you off with, you passed through Lebanon, and I know on June 3rd you wrote an article in Lebanon in which you said the government there was not enthusiastic about Syrians voting. Is that true? Is that what your analysis was?
Well, I wouldn't say the government. I would say the government there, you have to remember, is basically technocratic / coalition government. So
I left out the key. Yes, the March 14. And please clarify for us that. Who is March 14?
Well, March 14th, they're basically run by the Hariri family. Saeed Hariri is the main member of the family politically. But it includes the entire clan, and they're one of the richest families in the world. And in Lebanon, they made their fortune by working for the Saudis in Lebanon and basically stealing and appropriating land from the poor in Beirut and impoverishing and indebting Lebanon. It's one of the countries with the highest debts per capita because of them. So, I mean, some people praise them as fixing Lebanon and Beirut, but they actually stole a lot from Lebanon. And they used the Syrian military actually to expand their economic influence in the country. So they are the center of March 14th. Their party is specifically called the Future Party or the Future Movement, and they have some allies, which include the Falange, which are part of the March 14th. The Falange, like the Lebanese forces of Samir Jaja, these are Christian. He's a Christian warlord, basically, and he said Lebanon belongs for the Christians. He wanted the Muslims to leave. They killed Muslims. They killed other Christians as well. It includes very draconian figures. It used to include the Druze warlord from the mountains, Walid Jumblatt. He's not part of it, but he's still associated to them.
Permanently bouncing ball, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. He's like a changing weather vane. This is March 14th, and they criticized. They were very upset that they said, how could these Syrians vote? They have the audacity to vote. And they said they're traitors. We should kick them out of their country. There's security a risk to Lebanon. And they were upset because in Lebanon, you know, they're saying that, look, Syria's not free. People are being forced to go to the ballot. But Lebanon and some other countries proved that this is not true. We can infer from the voting in Lebanon, where the majority of Syrian refugees went to freely, with no force, went to vote, and they voted for Bashar al-Assad, that this is actually the popular will of the Syrian people, and that's why they were upset and they were against these elections.
Yeah. By the way, the West and the March 14 and the Saudis and all had a terrible time with their optics, didn't they? I mean, because this became such a massive thing, you couldn't hide it.
Yeah, but they that hasn't stopped them from lying, you know.
That's what they do for a living.
Of course, in the last 4 days, in the same time frame as the Syrian presidential elections, you had the Algerian presidential elections, you had the Egyptian. I was briefly in Egypt before I came back from Lebanon and Syria. Mm-hmm. So you had the Egyptian presidential elections where General al-Sisi ran. And you also had the Ukrainian presidential elections. Now, the European Union said the elections in Egypt were free, democratic, and fair, but it condemned the Syrian elections. Yes. They didn't say much about the Algerian elections, and, of course, the European
Union. I think that was ignored until you just now said it. Frankly, I didn't even realize it.
Yeah, and the Ukrainian elections, well, I'm sure you know about because Ukraine is a hotspot, is the European Union and the United States supported what's happening. The irony is there's fighting in Ukraine, just like in Syria, and mm-hmm. they said because of the fighting in Syria, this can't be a legitimate election in the Syrian Arab Republic, but it is legitimate in Ukraine where there's fighting in a similar context. So, I mean, they're hypocrites either way, And this just exposes where they stand. It's based on their interests. It's not based on any principles. It's not based on any democratic values at all.
Yep.
It's really a talk shop.
Yes. Yeah, it's a classic, don't do as I do as I say. One last thing I want to make, it came up in your article from June 6th, just to remind folks, is that not only is March 14 all the things you describe, but they actually play at trying to put a pretty face on Saudi Arabia, right? They talk about reforms in Saudi Arabia.
Well, they've saluted. They as well as the anti-government forces in Syria, have saluted King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, King Abdullah, as a Democrat. They've actually called them Democrats, or even the monarchs and autocrats in the other Gulf or Khaliji countries, such as the UAE, Bahrain. They've saluted all these people as Democrats, and they're saying there's no problem there. They're free countries.
Yes.
You know, that's the irony. I remember just before the protests in Egypt broke out in 2011, the Lebanese forces of Samir Jaja, they had a picture of Mubarak with him, and I think Amin Jamal might have been involved with that too, but they had a picture and they saluted him as this great leader and Democrat, and they quickly took it off. I mean, these people are absolute hypocrites.
Simply for sale, I gather.
And they've abused the Syrian refugees in Lebanon, and they're stealing their money that's coming from international organizations as well as the United Nations. A lot of it is being pocketed, the mm-hmm. money for these Syrian refugees in Lebanon. These Syrian refugees in Lebanon are also being exploited as cheap labor, prostituted, being sold as wives to people from the Gulf and other places in the world. I mean, and this is what they're doing. And on top of that, they have the audacity to say we support war in Syria or regime change because we care about the Syrian people. They don't care about the Syrian people. In fact, they're very bigoted towards the Syrian people as well as the Palestinian people. The mm-hmm. the people in the March 14th politicians are extremist bigots.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, of course, are bin Ladenites. They support Osama bin Laden as well.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the figures that the West, the so-called West, the United States, the Harper regime here in Canada, and our EU allies are calling Democrats in Lebanon. You know, and they refuse to recognize the elections in Syria. I was there as an international observer, and I can tell you that regardless of what you think of Bashar al-Assad, the majority of Syrian people like him, and that he's a popular figure for the majority of them. Many of them didn't like Bashar al-Assad before this.
Yeah.
They like him now.
Well, by the way, speaking to that, and I want to remind everybody, this is Mahdi Nazim Roya, and you can find his writing at particularly globalresearch.ca, and he is the author of The Globalization of NATO, and we all remember him also, too, as the one who was on the scene reporter of the destruction of Libya by NATO. Now, yes, on the matter of Assad, obviously, a country that's under attack, if the population understands that they are being victimized by bigots and terrorists and foreign-sponsored, they're going to rally to whoever will resist. It seems to me it's so logical. I don't understand why anybody would be surprised that the people would say, we're with him.
Well, once again, we're dealing with liars here that have their own agendas. They're not surprised. They know the truth, but they don't want the public to know the truth because they want to justify mm-hmm. The siege against Libya. They want to justify all of the illegal actions. They want to justify the illegal shipments of weapons to these people who are eating people's hearts out and killing nuns and priests and Muslim sheikhs, you know, who are destroying churches.
There's no Christian outcry here against the destruction of Christian institutions, yet they make a huge, outcry against Muslims and against Arabs generally, but not when these guys destroy churches in their attempt to overthrow Assad. Let's ask you about, what did you see? Where were you in Syria?
Well, I was in Damascus. I traveled by land route from the Beirut-Damascus highway. I had to go through Bekaa Valley, passed by near Baalbek, crossed the border, straight to the capital in Damascus. I was in Damascus governorate, the countryside. I went to the south of Syria. in terms of the presidential elections. I was one of the international observers who flew to Latakia. I was my mandated area or assigned area was Tartus, where the Russian naval base is, the government of Tartus. Mm-hmm. I flew there with the North Korean delegates from the parliament of North Korea and some Russian officials as well as Pakistani members of the media and some Pakistani politicians and one American. We were sent. Mm-hmm. We all flew to Latakia together. Then one group was responsible for the northern coast, and I was responsible for the southern part of the coast all the way to the Lebanese border. I visited internal camp of displaced Syrians, refugees, essentially, from places like Aleppo, Idlib. Wow. I talked to them. They all voted. A lot of people left the areas that the insurgents controlled just to go vote. Mm-hmm. So, by the way,
that is considerable risk, right? The insurgents were saying they were going to strike at anyone who voted, right?
Well, let me tell you, the night before the elections, or the two nights before the elections, they were attacking any communications. They wanted a media blackout on the elections. So they did attack. The internet went off for a bit. The other thing is, right after the elections, their answer to the elections was to attack the outskirts of Damascus further. So you started hearing mortars, more mortar attacks, like over 220 kilometers from Damascus in the countryside. There were still some areas where there's fighting. Daraya, for example, you could see it from the top of my hotel, was part of the front. I mean, their answer to the elections was to increase the attacks. And mm-hmm. an answer of the United States and its allies has been to send more weapons. This is their answer to democratic reforms, is to send more weapons, and the Turks have closed down water going to, they've shut down the Tigris-Euphrates, they're blocking the water, so it's affecting not only Syria, but Iraq, and that's deliberate to cause agricultural, economic, and demographic problems in Syria, as well as Iraq.
By the way, that isn't remarked on enough. I'm really glad you raised that. How long has this policy been in place? How long have they been doing it?
Blocking the water, there's been problems in the past, even to the...
I know the water has to be one of the most sensitive questions.
I'm sorry?
I said I know that certainly in that region, water has to be one of the most central questions.
Oh, yeah, of course, for agriculture, it's very important. But recently, they're using this as a mean of creating famine, droughts, and attacking the economy of Syria, as well as Iraq, destabilizing both. So... this is their answer to democracy. When people vote, when reforms are coming in, they increase weapons shipments and they shut down the water. They blockade the water from going into Syria. And it's very clear they want the government to collapse. It has nothing to do with it being democratic or not. It has nothing to do with popularity, nothing to do with humanitarianism, nothing to do with caring about the Syrian people. I met a lot of the refugees, okay? And... they had very clear messages to people like Mr. Obama and Mr. Harper. You want to destroy our country? We're not going to let you. And for them, this was really a referendum. It wasn't an election per se. It was a referendum.
I got that impression. Exactly.
Yeah, it was a referendum to show that to restate the legitimacy of the government, the president and the government, and it was a vote of confidence, basically, in the government.
Mm-hmm. By the way, it's very interesting how this can't be noted, or that, for example, the British population, we all understand how they felt when Germany was bombing them. They were all united. They were going to give up, and they were obviously going to rally. And it's just a simple analogy which people can't make. If outsiders cause their discomfort and loss of life and threaten to destroy them, well, they're going to rally, of course.
Well, not only that. You have outsiders who are coming, cutting throats, massacring everyone in the village, raping children.
Yeah, true terrorism. The strategy actually is terrorist.
Mass executions, using basically the Salvador option, which the United States developed in Latin America against the people in Syria. Of course they're going to rally behind the government. Like I said earlier, there are people who did not support Bashar al-Assad. They did not like the Ba'athists. But they support the government now, and they support him now because they see this as the only way to save their country, their society, their families, and their communities. Yeah.
But I saw an interview with Bashar Assad, and by the way, I hope people will go to the various sites where they could actually listen to Syrians talk and Syrian leaders. But he made it, he was being interviewed, and he said, well, you know, when the French left, when the colonialists left, he said, it was with a plan to come back. And that, I thought, was very true, and anybody who understands about the struggle against colonialism has to understand it, that they are not, they don't, it's like the French in Mali, they're back, and they say, well, why are you the French in Mali? And they say, well, we used to be here, you know.
That's absolutely correct. When they leave, they always leave traces behind. There's some sort of link. For example, the British and French used foreign aid to control these countries, or development aid. They would give it specifically to their former colonies, which actually kept them in the states as vassals, was designed to keep them as vassals in some way or another. But I've heard this from people in the oil industry in the Middle East, where they said that, for example, when the British were leaving, they started fixing things up, and they very frankly told them, we are gone now, but we'll be back sooner or later. I mean, it's absolutely correct. Can I point something out? I was also in the National Assembly of Syria, their parliament. I met with MPs at various points, but in the parliament of the Syrian Arab Republic, the People's Assembly, I met with the Speaker of the Syrian Parliament, and he pointed out something. The first people to bomb and attack the Syrian parliament when Syria was on the road of democracy, and this is before Hafez al-Assad or the Assad family, were the French. Uh-huh. When the Syrians decided to create a republic, who would attack them but the French? Mm-hmm. So these colonials don't care about democracy whatsoever. The democracy is always a justification. Before, it used to be spreading Christianity, white man's burden, these type of things. But humanitarianism and democracy are the new pretext for these wars against these countries.
Yes. But, you know, again, this is Mahdi Nazemroya, who wrote the wonderful book, The Globalization of NATO, Clarity Press. You can read him at globalresearch.ca. The concept of American democracy is being rather nakedly spoken of now in the case of the President of the United States speaking at West Point, saying, he said, and I believe in every fiber of my being in American exceptionalism. And then he said, America is the one indispensable country in the world. You know, they are reaching a kind of drunken mad state with those kind of positions. I remember when this, and I want to talk to you about your 2006 article about Condoleezza Rice and her comments, but when they said we're going to have a new Middle East, a Syrian politician, I can't identify, I just remember reading, he said, well, I don't mind if you say we're going to have a new world order if you mean by democracy I'm going to be elected to the United States Senate or to the American Congress. But he said, that isn't what you're talking about. You're talking about dictating to us what kind of Congress we will have. He said, but you're not inviting me to be part of your Congress.
Well, I have to point something out. The democracy in the United States is very deficient, just like it is in Canada. So, I mean, we have to understand that we don't live in true democracies ourselves. Number two is all the talk about democracy is, most people won't be able to answer directly. They'll give you a superficial answer on what democracy is. Mm-hmm. I mean, a democracy is not just voting. Voting is a mechanism. You used to vote in a lot of places in the world. You still do that. The voting doesn't account to anything. It's decision-making. It means the people are involved in ruling. That means decision-making. So we don't live in a direct democracy. We use words like representative democracy to hide these things. You know, in Canada, we have a minority that forms a majority government. That tells you a lot. You have the system in the United States where presidents are not popular. The popular vote might be for the other candidate, but someone else might be the president. So this is not a democracy. And even with these votings, people still don't get a say in how the direction of the country.
Well, we don't get representation, right? The polls show the Canadian people are very dubious, very skeptical of policies in Iraq and Syria, Iran, the nuclear weapons, all these, NATO. However, we don't have a member of parliament who will reflect that. Not one.
Well, these members of parliament are filtered. I mean, there's a filter before someone becomes an American president or a member of parliament in Canada. Most of the time, especially for the president. I mean, they have to be. They're filtered in. I mean, they check out who they won't. It's easy for you to. It's much easier to be elected than to become a candidate within one of these parties. You know, the yes. party first has to allow you to run for them. So that's an issue. But if you want to look at a deficit in democracy, you need to look at the European Union, which thinks of itself as civilizationally superior to the rest of the world as yes. the cradle. I mean, most people don't like EU policies. Most people don't. How is the president of the European Union selected? You know, or the head of the European Commission? How are these people selected? It's not democratic whatsoever. These are technocratic monsters. Mm-hmm. So they have no right to talk to people about democracy and local systems of government. I mean, there are different types. There's not one type of democracy, even though I'm saying that all these democracies are incomplete. There's not one type of system of governance, but yet they want to destroy any alternatives. They want to have a monopoly on how the world is shaped. This is what the New World Order is. It's basically everything in the shape of the United States.
And they have not gone off that game plan. They're a little rattled because they ran into a problem with the leader of Russia and various other states. But they seem to only be more determined and more incensed at the situation to have hegemony. We're speaking to Mahdi Nazemroya. GlobalResearch.ca is where you can find many of his recent articles. And, of course, he's written The Globalization of NATO, Clarity Press. And I better get you on to – we have to find out from you what are we to make of the sudden, you know, army in the desert that just popped up out of a dust storm and it allegedly is marching on Baghdad. You're the person – you have an article, June 14, Redrawing the Map, which, by the way, you wrote in 2006. Seems to be very timely today. What about this desert army?
Well, we should clearly state or clearly understand that both Iraq and Syria are linked. They're not just ancient neighbors. They're not just tied to one and each other throughout history, but – The policy of the United States on Syria and Iraq is interlinked. In fact, Syria used to be in the U.S.'s European Union. Like, the U.S. had boundaries, military boundaries of command and control. And Syria and Lebanon used to be, along with Israel, used to be in the European designated area. And around when they invaded Iraq, they switched it into the CENTCOM area of control because their objectives were tied in both countries. The destabilization of Iraq prior to 2011 was tied to destabilizing Syria. In fact, the Americans wanted to march into Damascus after Baghdad. They were talking about it.
Yeah, they use that the old expression, the road to Damascus is through Baghdad, or the road to Damascus is through Amman. They move it around as to which way they want to go in.
Yeah, they were saying things like real men go to Tehran, for example. Yeah. You know, they were also looking at Iran. Iran can't be separated from this equation, just like how Russia and China can't, or Armenia, or Ukraine. The destabilization of Iraq has destabilized Syria, and the destabilization of Syria has further destabilized Iraq. They started with these divisions amongst the Arabs, primarily on religious sects, so between Sunni Muslims and Shiite Muslims, as well as Christians, the Christian minorities. And then they've moved on to divisions between the ethnic Arabs and the ethnic Kurds in the mountains of Kurdistan. So they've been playing these people against one another. And the ISIS, the ISIS, going into places, attacking places like Mosul and places in the northern part or on the Syrian-Iraqi border, the United States and Britain are totally to blame. They should be held accountable. We have to ask where the weapons have been coming from. You know, some of these weapons have come from Libya, from their adventures in Libya.
Yeah, and by the way, still do, don't you? I mean, a lot of this is just hypocritical behavior. There's somebody consciously making sure all these guys get their hardware.
Of course, and these weapons have been, all their adventures are interlinked. These adventures, these acts of aggression, international crime against the peace, war crimes, crimes against humanity are interlinked and feeding into one another. So weapons from Libya are going into Syria and Iraq. Weapons from Iraq prior to this were going to places like Libya. Training fighters from Iraq were going into Libya. Fighters from Libya are now going to Syria and Iraq. They've destabilized the border. They've weakened these governments. They've done everything to make that area of the world weak, and they ultimately want to break up these countries. They want to fragment them, or I'll use a much more technocratic or academic term, they want to balkanize them, like mm-hmm. divide them up like Yugoslavia was on that model, into little statelets that are weak, that can easily be controlled, that don't have access to the sea, for example.
Or the minority rulers depending upon Wasson.
And that hate each other.
Yeah.
You know, all these adventures that countries like Britain, Canada, the United States, and France get into, you know, they attack historic sites, they attack cultural sites, and that's deliberate. It's to erase identities and create new ones. You know, mm-hmm. they create a state of enemy, an anomic state in those societies, and then they when this state comes, people are very malleable to picking up new identities, and we should know that identities can kill. You know, it can be weaponized.
Oh, absolutely.
And they weaponize these identities and turn whole groups of people. They feed tribalism in the most vicious sense. And when I mean tribalism, I don't mean the tribe. I mean identities of I belong to this tribe, it's my tribe versus you. It's basically us versus them. They otherize others, and they make break communities and societies, turn them against each other. And they've been fueling this. Who, for example, was paying for printing the Taliban's textbooks that said kill Jews and Christians? They were printed in the United States. You know, this type of hate is used mm-hmm. and weaponized. And what's happened in Iraq is a manifestation of U.S. policy. You know, Tony mm-hmm. Blair has the audacity to say we should have gone war to Syria. We should have killed millions in Syria, and maybe this wouldn't have happened in Iraq. Instead of saying this war criminal, instead of accepting the fact that they destroyed Iraq, where there never was al-Qaeda or terrorism of this sort, where there never was really vicious sectarianism like we can see, is now saying that it's because we didn't go to war to Syria. Can you imagine someone saying, we should have gone to war with that country? If we went to war, we could have prevented this? Instead of accepting blame for his criminal actions in Iraq, which that illegal Anglo-American invasion, he's switching everything around. And while I'm on this subject, I'd like to point out the Human Rights Watch, we should call it, is an imperialist tool, definitely, mm-hmm. is starting to say that this al-Qaeda-linked group, ISIS, ISIS...
They're the good guys.
They're the good guys, essentially. They've tried to include people and not alienate them, while the Maliki government has not. And they talk about the Maliki government, which is democratically elected as a sectarian government. That's not true, first of all. Maybe the prime minister and a few key cabinet ministers are Shiites, but the government is actually proportionate to the demographic breakup of Iraq. So you have Sunnis, for example.
Yes, he's actually being attacked for that now. That policy is being attacked by the American pundit group have all agreed that we shouldn't do that, and have attacked his policy. It is a situation where they seem to be, I wonder if you have this impression, that they are starting something where it's rather difficult to know what they intend with this, because everybody's claiming we don't know them really, this is rather spontaneous, and it's Maliki's fault. But the ingredients are extremely volatile and lethal. And I assume they seem to be trying to create an issue where to almost blackmail the Islamic Republic, particularly if you're going to start the Shia-Sunni game.
It's been, Phil, they've been doing this for the past decade. I mean,
Now we have it. We seem to be entering a new chapter here with this phenomenon.
We have a new phase, of course, but I mean, let's be very frank. They've been trying to make Sunni and Shiite Muslims kill each other. They've been trying to make Iranians and Arabs and Turks go at each other's throats for decades.
Yes, certainly in Syria.
Certainly in Lebanon. Certainly in Iraq before this. I think I should point out that the people that have gone to Syria, they started out being paid by the United States in Iraq and trained by the United States in Iraq. They're American-funded, a lot of them. I mean, even the Washington Post admitted this many years ago, that they're American-funded. This phenomenon is a manifestation of U.S. policy in that region. You know, the direction has not changed. The direction is to create utter chaos in that part of the world. Of course, weaken the Iranians because they're the major power in that part of the world. Mm-hmm. They are the foremost power in the Middle East. I mean, mm-hmm. The Americans like to make the Israelis look very strong. They like the Turks to be strong under neo-Ottomanism, failed neo-Ottomanism. But when it comes down to it, the foremost power in that region is the Iranians. They are independent in their foreign policy, regardless of whether people like the government there or the ideology of the government. They are still independent. They support any opposition to the United States or Israel.
And they're very stable.
They've always been a sea of stability. Yeah. And the United States has always tried to break that. It's a hard nut to crack. Mm-hmm. Just like Russia and China. They're trying to do the same thing with Russia and China. They're antagonizing the Chinese, this Asia-Pacific pivot, setting mm-hmm. up, sending more naval assets there, instigating problems between the Chinese and their neighbors. They're doing the same thing with the Russians vis-a-vis Ukraine, trying to break Russia's economic links to the European Union. I mean, this is going to be a lot. When Russia breaks its ties between the Russian Federation and the European Union are affected negatively further, it's going to be bad for the Europeans. But the United States government doesn't care about this because it's using the same strategies it used during World War I and World War II. It lets everybody on the other side of the Pacific Atlantic kill each other. Then it comes and it benefits off reconstruction, buying out companies, and it destroys its competitors. And that's why it's pushing the European Union on this antagonistic path towards Russia. And that's why in the Middle East it's trying to make Sunni Muslims hate Shiite Muslims, and specifically to hate Iran because it's a predominantly Shiite Muslim country, although at least 10-15% of the population is Sunni Muslim.
Yeah, and they're not persecuted and are supporters of the government.
Of course, I've seen...
Rather like Syria, actually.
The majority of supporters of the government in Syria are Sunni Muslims. But speaking of Iraq, I've seen propaganda about Iran saying... these are Arab Sunnis being killed in Iran, okay? But this is where they're absolutely wrong in their ignorance about Iran. It becomes very clear to anybody who's knowledgeable about Iran or Iranian society. First of all, the Sunnis in Iran are not Arabs. All the Arabs that are in Iran are Shiites. Mm-hmm. The Sunnis are mostly Persians and Baluch. Mm-hmm. So when they start saying these things, it's very easy to pick up that they're making up lies, and I've seen them even putting up pictures of people who were criminals executed in Iran, saying they were executed because they're Sunni or Arab, and that is not correct at all. But that's part of the same type of lies that you see them produce all the time. For example, the BBC aired this totally fabricated report involving doctors who were actually related to people on the anti-government Syrian National Council. And then it redid their voices when the context of the situation changed. So it utterly fabricated, and even a British former diplomat to Central Asia has commented on that. So this type of fabrication lies is part of their modus operandi. Yeah.
By the way, part of what you're saying leads us to conclude that they're not really very good, despite their, you know, it's like the evil doctor who can't seem to get his chemistry together. You know, it's like they get caught an awful lot. In these false pictures or statements or declarations about another government and what's going on, maybe it's the internet, but certainly they get caught more frequently than I recall in the past. We're speaking to Mahdi Nazarbayev, and we have to go, but I want to thank you very, very much, and to remind everybody to go to globalresearch.ca and pick up the Mahdi's book, The Globalization of NATO. By the way, you have a new book coming out, don't you?
Yes, I'd like to take the opportunity to mention that I've also contributed to a book with people like Edward Herman and Michelle Chizdovsky, Professor Parente, on Ukraine as well. We have a book on the crisis in Ukraine. It's also from Clarity Press, and that has also come out, and I'd like to point that out to listeners.
Oh, thank you.
There's a book called Flashpoint Ukraine.
Is it out or is it going to be out?
It is out. It's out for order. It's myself and 22 authors, most of them professors from different parts of North America.
As soon as we get our hands on it, we'd like to ask you to please come and talk to us about that book.
I would be my pleasure. It would be my pleasure. And as soon as I return to Ottawa from you from Winnipeg here, I'm waiting for my copy.
Well, you, I tell you something. A lot of people want that book. This is a topic everybody wants to know more about it. Mahdi Nazemroya, thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. That's globalresearch.ca. And if you go to his name there, you, of course, find the accumulated articles. I was very struck by the fact that the article he wrote in 2006 holds up so well that they reprinted it, talking about the new Middle East. Most authors pray that people won't see what was written a year ago. You know, they, oh my God, I hope nobody goes back and looks.